Hey, everybody, thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Preacher Boys podcast. I make this show for you, and I hope that you really enjoy it. I have a lot of people that ask me how they can support the show financially, and you can do that by heading over to patreon.com/preacherboys. You're going to get access to exclusive content, including early releases of episodes. I've got a couple episodes right now that have been released at least a month early over on Patreon. You've got access to things like unique merch, depending on what tier you join, and you get access to some behind the scenes content that I'm posting within the group. So head over to patreon.com/preacherboys and become a member over there today. Every single supporter helps make this show a little bit more possible, especially as I continue to add additional episodes and content every single week. Thank you so much for tuning in. Let's get back to the show.
It's one thing to be a spokesperson on behalf of someone, but it's another thing to be proximate enough to learn the stories of individuals that you want to pass the microphone to.
Yeah.
We don't need any more people being a voice for the voiceless. We have voices already. Some people's voices are heard while others are silenced. We need advocates that are daring and bold enough to use their privilege to pass the microphone.
Trigger warning. This podcast contains descriptions of various abusive situations. Listener discretion is advised. You are listening to the Preacher Boys podcast, a podcast shedding light on decades of mental, physical, and sexual abuse within the independent fundamental Baptist movement. The testimonies shared on this podcast are told from the personal experience and perspective of the survivors. Not all legal outcomes are known or final. Any suspect is presumed innocent until proven guilty in the court of law. To find more information about the Preacher Boys podcast and upcoming documentary, visit PreacherBoysDoc.com or connect on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter with the handle at PreacherBoysDoc. Now, here is your host, Eric Skwarzynski.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the Preacher Boys podcast. Terrence, thank you so much for joining me on today's show.
Eric, I'm really excited to be here and have a conversation with you.
I was telling you right before I hit record, the reason I really wanted to chat with you is I think there's a lot of people, when they find out about any kind of issue, whether it's homelessness, whether it's poverty, whether it's, you know, sexual abuse, whatever that issue is, people get really passionate about doing something about it. You know, they get that kind of fire burning, say, I want to do something, I want to help. But there's not a lot of really good resources out there for those who want to be advocates and for those that want to make a difference and learn how they can be a part in making the world a little bit of a better place. I wanted to bring you on to kind of talk through that. Your book, When We Stand, is really a great kind of toolbox to kind of walk you through some of that. But tell me a little bit about your journey. What got you started on the path that you're currently on? What is it that, you know, first opened your eyes to some changes that need to be made? And how did you begin your journey as an advocate?
Yeah, it's a great question and great lean in. Firstly, I would like to say that advocacy is not a momentary thing. It's something that you should commit yourself to with an elongated view of being involved in an issue. I think we kind of like over sensationalize advocacy in the modern context, where advocacy is all reduced down to a trend and not necessarily something that is seen as something that you should commit and give your entire life to. And I use that as a segue because I never saw myself being in the work that I'm currently doing. I think one of the pivotal moments for me was realizing how my own trauma could be something that was empowering and liberating versus being something that is oppressive. I know on this show, you talk a lot about people you know, escaping sex trafficking and abusive situations. And so, although my story isn't ideally that, there was a lot of traumatic experiences that I had early on in my childhood. I could talk about how, you know, at 16 and a half years old, I experienced acute homelessness from time to time, sleeping in parks, et cetera, and never really even thought about how the pain that I was experiencing in the moment would be translated or have some type of transmutation to be used for something for the greater good. I had a mentor, come into my life early on when I was a lot younger, that would call out the good things with me. And it wasn't from a perspective of him trying to just, you know, do something cool for the moment. Mr. Moore was a person that was really proximate in my life and practiced this idea of presence, right? He saw me not as a project, but as someone that he could walk alongside. And I think, with him showing up in my life was, you know, a huge catalyst for my life starting to change and for me, you know, starting to find my own sense of self and my own voice and my own purpose in my faith. Essentially he became a disciple, and I'll never forget, years before starting the organization when we had a very intentional conversation, and he told me that at some moment in my life, I would be able to use the things that I have been liberated from to relate to other people who are also caught in the struggles. And it just so happened to translate into a nonprofit. I never thought that I would be in ministry in this way or doing the type of work that I'm doing. But I allowed that pain to become a guide, right? I was able to embrace it. I was able to work through and process a lot of the things that I had gone through, but it became a guide. And once it becomes a guide, it also produces a gift. And that gift is served to the world. And so I found advocacy not only through intellect and understanding the plights that are prevalent in society and culture as it relates to people experiencing homelessness and poverty, but I tapped into this inner resource, right, of things that I had gone through and using those things as a vehicle to develop compassion and empathy towards others who are also caught in the same types of plight.
Yeah, I want to take a step off to the side for a second, because there's a part of your story that I think is interesting. You know, you have a mentor who is kind of there with you. Like you said, and I love that you say this, it's not a moment. Like, this is a lifestyle, like trying to help people, trying to encourage other people. But one of the things that you mentioned is that he told you, you know, one day this is going to be used in a really good way. One day you're going to be able to share this. And, you know, I've seen people that do this in a really good, healthy way, but a lot of people, I think, reach in and almost make someone's situation or make someone's trauma small. You know, they go in and say, yeah, this happened to you, but, you know, all things work together for good, you know, and then they kind of leave you with that and jump, you know, or they'll come in and say, you know, well, God has a plan for everything, and pat you on the shoulder and walk out. So what is a way for somebody who maybe hasn't experienced a specific trauma to be able to reach over, encourage somebody without, you know, belittling the experience or the gravity of the trauma that they've experienced?
Man, that's a great point. And I can tell you emphatically that it took years and years and years of leaning in and failing and falling and having someone as a Mr. Moore with, grace for me to process all of the work that is needed for recovery. I think any type of person of faith that wants to rush a person past their grief or past the traumatic experiences is very toxic, right? If we do that, then why was Jesus on the cross? Why was Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane? Why did Jesus go through the excruciating pain of the suffering? I think the part of Jesus that we get a chance to relate to most is that suffering, right? That, idealistic Christians tend to rush past. And so for me, I think to be a healthy advocate, I think sometimes it's just the proximity of presence. I think too often we try to rush to give people answers, right? And in many cases, there are no quick fixes, right?
Yeah.
Some people take years to overcome trauma. I mean, years, brother, of continuing to show up and, you know, cry and question and wrestle and wrestle in the grayness, right? Mm-hmm. I think oftentimes people think that because you are a person of faith that you're always on, right? And that isn't the type of Jesus that I would like to display to others who are caught in the plights that I have no real understanding about. I think many times we try to set ourselves up as the experts in people's lives and miss the opportunity to just be present. Sometimes being present is just listening. Sometimes being present is just checking in. Sometimes being present is showing up without any answers, right? And validating someone's existence and someone's trauma and someone's realities, their existential realities, without trying to heal. That's one of the reasons why I like the writer Henry Nouwen, right? Because he talks a lot about people returning home, right? And getting a sense of self and being and finding out that they're the beloved of God. But sometimes that takes a process, right? We shouldn't try to push people into a process of recovery long before they are ready to fully recover. And I see that as the God of, you know, the God that shows up through people who are humble enough not to give answers.
It speaks to, in the book you mentioned, like, we have an empathy deficit, you know, and I thought that was a really interesting way to say that. You know, we have this, for whatever reason, we struggle with, just like you said, leaning in, listening, hearing what another person has to say. And I think one of the reasons we struggle is that it does take patience. You know, I think we want to, you know, whether we would audibly say it or not, we do tend to look at ourselves as wise or experts, or, you know, and if I say this verse at the right time, or if I say this quote at the right time, this is going to change everything and undo years of trauma. And that's just not how it works. I definitely want to, we'll talk a little bit more of the advocacy side, but I also want to go to the flip side, because you mentioned, you know, the process of taking it from where your trauma is essentially a God in your life. It's something that you're spending a lot of time really, you know, really you're stuck in this position of, like, I was in this horrible, horrible situation. And I think there's a balance there, right? Like, you experience something horrible, you're going to spend, like, that's never going to leave you. Like, trauma stays with you your entire life, like, just mentally and, and psychologically, it stays with you. Can you talk a little bit about, maybe even just using your own self as a personal example, how do you go from, you know, talking about it, dwelling in it in an unhealthy way, to being able to, it's still a big part of your story, and being able to share it in a healthy way and being able to deal with it and process it in a way that is healthy for you and positive for you?
Yeah, well, I think that happens in phases. I think the first phase of that is, you know, it is the awareness of it. This is something that has, you know, affected me in some way, whether consciously or unconsciously, but really doing that internal work and wrestling with the realities of how the trauma has affected you. I think the second step is, you know, finding those safe spaces, licensed safe spaces, right? Because Christians can do a lot of damage.
Say it again.
to people's mental health, right? And, you know, I was able to find those spaces early on to help process some of the things that I had no answers for. Mm-hmm. And the goal of counseling or any type of psychotherapist, it's not necessarily to give you answers, but to help you to make discoveries on your own, right? Mm-hmm. I think that is the healthy part of counseling. I have a graduate degree in mental health counseling, and I later learned that later on that the goal of counseling is not to necessarily give answers. And I found those spaces that would help me first express my feelings about it, right? And then as I express my feelings, that gave me some sense of understanding, right? And then I was able to express my emotions about what I understood. And then ultimately I was able to let it go. And when I say let it go from having control over me, which is the other part of the healthy process. Because if you don't express your feelings, right, whatever feelings you have that derives from whatever traumatic experience, if you don't have someone who is licensed and a professional helping you to understand alternative ways of looking at it, or even questioning and reflecting back to you, your processes, then you won't tap into the emotions. And I think in the unconscious are where the emotions are suppressed and are frozen, right? That gives us the low affect, right? Which affects us personally. But you go through that process ultimately to let it go, brother. And it was, you know, moments in my life where I started to accept things that happened and remove myself as the problem of why they happen, which is huge, because you stop internalizing as if it's your fault. And then you start to process it as something, as being something that you could accept that I've gone through. But then you realize that you're not the only one, right? That there's a community of suffering that has same or similar types of things. And then I think the last thing was also placing myself in a community of people that would continue to be a support. And I think there's something to be said about vulnerability, that when we choose to be vulnerable in safe spaces until we build up our confidence, that it actually reinforces our voice as we discover how our voice has been shaped by the trauma that we've gone through.
That's really powerful. I definitely want to talk. I mean, like I mentioned, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about this lifestyle of being an advocate of, you know, whether you want to call it advocacy, activism, you know, taking, being mobilized to try to attack a certain problem. And, you know, for you, that has been, you know, homelessness, that has been really, you've been going full force taking that on. And, first and foremost, I guess I would want to know, One of the big issues, I think, for, you know, for a lot of us, is we see so many different issues in the world. There's so many things we can tackle. How do you choose where your time is best spent addressing a certain issue? Obviously, your personal experience can help guide you to what you're going to address. But for somebody who's listening, who's saying, you know, we have homelessness, we have abuse, we have, you know, an orphan crisis in this country, like, how do you recommend people sit down and, you know, figure out where to extend that work? Because a lot of us stretch ourselves and say, oh, we give some money here, give some money here. But I think having a focus on a certain issue is really important if we want to be effective. So how do you recommend someone go about doing that?
I can take you a little bit through my process and then hopefully can offer some suggestions. And for me, it's always started with things that are very existential and present in my life. I think that kind of shapes my heart to be a little more sensitive to issues, you know, and then there are things where, it has affected people that I care about. Right. And those people are close to me. And so I've seen many people become really passionate about things that have affected, loved ones. And then, you know, another thing that helped me early on was just getting active. You know, figuring out what was around me in my social location, you know, researching, you know, understanding my own wiring and my gifts and my skill sets, and not just like blindly picking a place, but seeing how I'm wired as an individual could fit the type of environment that I may discover. Yeah. You know, one thing about getting active is that you get a chance to find out really quickly what you like and what you don't like. You know, it's like I went skiing one time never again, right?
Yeah.
I tried it out. I thought it was cool. I think the pictures are cool when they're posted online, but would I get involved in skiing again? No, never again. And I think it's going through that process of getting involved and being, you know, really, you know, really practical with how many, you know, projects you can get involved with. Yeah. And then asking yourself hard questions, you know, what is it about this project that makes me want to show up again?
Yeah.
You know, what is it about this project that keeps me up at night or wakes me up in the early AM that makes me really irritated or agitated? You know, those are some of the telltale signs that, you know, this is a thing that you are really drawn to. And then understanding that it's something that you don't force, right? Like when I get up in the morning, I don't feel like I'm forcing the work that I'm doing, right? I have this sense of peace that comes about when I'm doing this work. And it almost feels as though it's second nature, right? And it doesn't feel like a task. You know, you want to involve yourself in the things that don't really feel burdensome. Is it okay to care about many different issues? Yeah. But when it comes to focus, you want to zero in on the things that aligns with your skill sets, your gifts, maybe geography, the location around you, and the things that agitate you the most. You know, everybody has things that agitates them from a broader perspective, but only you know those things or that one thing that really just irks you the most. And as a mentor used to say in the past, whatever makes you mad, if you use the word mad as an acronym, that's the area you're supposed to make a difference in.
You kind of mentioned obviously putting on a false front or like forcing, you know, maybe not even a false front, but just forcing yourself into a position where, look, I'm an advocate, you know, and you know, people mock corporations all the time for slapping a logo on their website or you know, doing something to look like they're supportive of somebody when it's really just a PR thing. But I think also for a lot of people, I think they sense that it is something they need to do. And so they're just kind of scattershot trying to jump onto every, you know, every movement, help with every different, you know, situation. But you mentioned your book, like busyness doesn't always mean you're being effective. You know, you can be involved in a lot of different things. You can be spreading yourself across a bunch of different ministries and things like that. But can you talk a little bit about getting very focused and getting more effective? You can even bring in, you mentioned your let go list in the book, you know, kind of what are some of the things you can do to really get singular in your focus and actually start being effective?
Often say it's not a matter of willingness, it's a matter of availability, right? Mm-hmm. We have a lot of people who are willing to get involved in issues, but they don't have the margin to actually get involved in a single issue or focused area in the rhythmic way. I'm not talking about the event orientation of service or justice work. I'm talking about making this area of focus a part of the fabric of who you are as a person. And that starts with margin, right? If you can only get involved once or twice a year, then you have to really ask yourself, do I have too many things on my plate that's keeping me from doing the work of God in an area where I may be needed most? And, you know, so often we are concerned with, you know, the to-do list. What do I have to do next? And we love constructing calendars and building out things to feel productive. But busyness doesn't always correlate to productivity. And we know this, right? There are some people who have become really busy and they use busyness as a distraction from doing the internal work that we were talking about earlier. They're running from trauma or running from some aspect of their lives, and they try to keep a full schedule or a calendar to distract themselves from that. And then there are other people who just like the badge of honor of burnout, right? Like, I just want to always have the rebuttal that, you know, I'm busy. Busyness is not a badge of honor. It's actually something that keeps you from doing the work of God, or, you know, walking humbly and doing justly, right? I think, so to go back to my point, we need to kind of move into what I call the let go list. We need to be real with ourselves about the things that we are involved in that may not necessarily be bad things. They may be good things, but they're not the things that have any eternal value or the things that we are actually leveraging to make a difference or the things that will be most meaningful to us. But we get sucked into attachments, right?
Oh, right.
We get really attached to doing things a certain way or having some things on our calendar because we think if we are void of those things, then somehow something will be missing. And what I'm arguing in that chapter is, you know, your let go list and the things that you really wrestle with that you need to remove off your plate could actually free yourself up to get involved in the single cause or issue that you've been longing to get involved with, not in an event orientation, but in the rhythmic way where it becomes a part of your everyday life.
Right. Well, it goes back to what you're saying. Like, it's not a moment. So like when you have it, you know, for me with sexual abuse, like that's not something I think about from 6 o'clock to 8 o'clock on my calendar. Like that's something that's always somewhere in the back of my head. It's not constantly overwhelming noise, you know, which it used to be when I first became aware of the issue. But now but it is this low kind of hum in the background going like, that is there. Like, that's just part of something I'm always thinking about. How can you address it? How can you talk about it better? How can you create something that's going to raise attention on it? But like you said, it's not something I'm having to remind myself to think about or remind myself, oh, I have to be passionate about this today. And you see a lot of people do that, you know, it's almost that mission trip mentality. You know, it's like from this day to this day, I'm really passionate about Uganda, you know, like we're going to go paint schools and then you're never going to worry about it ever again. It's easy to do that with a lot of these different, you know, opportunities for activism, because there's plenty of causes to do that for. And there's plenty that, you know, like a ski trip, look really good on Instagram, you know, if you can snap that picture, you know, here and there. So,
yeah. And to your point, that's what we want to push back against.
Yeah.
Is the, you know, the one-offs. I think we need more people who view service as a lifestyle, who views their cause as a part of the fabric of their core values, right?
Yeah.
Who even see it as an act of worship unto God, which is a bold statement because we normally think about worship in a corporate setting, but service itself can be an act of worship.
Yeah.
You know, that out of the outflow of my heart, I'm showing up for my community. I'm standing up for the justice issue that plagues my neighbor, right?
Yeah.
And if I'm called to love my neighbor, I also have to be concerned about the neighborhood that the neighbor emerges from,
right,
and the issues that the neighborhood faces, right?
Right.
It's just going a little deeper down in being more proximate and present. Right. And I think what you just said was spot on.
Yeah. Hey, everybody, we're going to get back to the show in just a minute. But before our brief intermission, I'd like to introduce a thought-provoking new podcast called Psychotherapy. That's two words if you're going to go search for it right now. This show sheds light on the very real issue of abusive therapists and pastoral counselors. In every helping profession, including therapy, there's a vulnerability to exploitation. And Psychotherapy delves deep into the red flags, risks, and real-life stories of those affected by unethical practices. Tune in to Psychotherapy with Leah Denton on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your shows.
I'm Leah Denton, and this is Psychotherapy, a show dedicated to providing survivors of therapy harm a platform to share their stories and to offer language for those of us trying to make sense of our own experiences with the psycho in the therapist chair.
Well, I mean, I always think about James, where it says pure and undefiled religion is visiting the fatherless and widows, you know, and, you know, that idea of being socially active is in scripture, like the idea of going and caring for other people. And, you know, that's it's not, oh, you have your spiritual side, then you have your side that's helping people. Like it's all combined when you get into that conversation. I do want to speak into that a little bit. So one of the things that, you know, we've mentioned a little bit, kind of spiritually bypassing people, you know, oh, let's try to rush you through this so you can see the good in the situation. I kind of want to talk into that from the perspective of the church, you know, and I think a lot of times we can be really, and maybe you haven't seen this, but I feel like I've seen this a lot, is that we treat people as transactions. Like it's how quickly can I get them to accept the gospel? How quickly can I get them into a small group? How quickly can I get them to be healed enough to jump into a ministry position or work in a nursery or whatever that is? Can you speak to maybe pastors, Christians, you know, ministry workers, you know, can you kind of speak into that and being willing to serve people who may never, you know, become a part of your church, being willing to serve people who may not be interested in the gospel, being willing to minister to people that aren't part of your team, essentially. 'Cause I think sometimes there's this mentality. I've seen homeless shelters, you know, where, you know, we won't serve them a meal until they listen to a gospel presentation, or we won't, you know, give them a room unless they are attending services here, and you know, this kind of stuff. Can you talk a little bit about that and how we can serve people even if they're not part of our quote unquote camp?
Yeah, man, I think that for me, it's we never see Jesus doing that. And to be honest, I think it can become very toxic when you make your love, conditional and based upon qualifiers, right? Yeah. That if you are operating from a space where people have to qualify to be loved by God through you, then you're doing God a disservice. That can become very damaging, bro. I've seen so many people experiencing homelessness hurt and turned off much more by the expectations that Christians had placed on them than by the genuine love of God that should have been present with not even ever saying anything. And my whole stance on this is, I don't think people should have to qualify for me to express the love of God towards them. I don't have any expectations of people, walking in certain spaces that I feel like they need to walk into to be accepted, because I'm coming from a place of wanting to really embody what Jesus meant when he says, you know, go out into the highways and the byways, be present with people.
Yeah.
You know, it's this extending the table mentality. And I think oftentimes churches can, forget that they are called to extend tables of welcome and start building walls of distance, because all of the qualifiers are walls and they separate us from really sharing the love of God with people who may not be like us or come from the same social location or believe the same way that we do or have addresses in the gated communities that we have addresses in. And how dare we restrict the love of God based upon our own qualifiers that we have placed on people. So it just becomes a very toxic thing. And then I think it's a misrepresentation of the character of God, because people can look at that and say, well, how can I believe this God of love when you won't even accept me because I don't even have shoes on, or you won't let me into a restaurant and ask for water because I'm without an address? Like, it's all of these lists of things that we, you know, try to force people into. And the reality is that everybody won't darken the doors of your church. But that doesn't mean that they shouldn't have a meal or bed to sleep in or a roof over their heads. everybody won't listen to a gospel presentation. Sometimes the best gospel presentation is comes out through how you live out through your feet, right? It's orthopraxy, you know. Sometimes the best gospel presentation is how did you love the person who could give you nothing in return, you know? And I, all throughout the text, man, that's how I see Jesus living his life. And Jesus was known for seeing people, you know. I love the passages that reads, and Jesus saw. And sometimes we see people, but we walk away when they don't fit our check boxes.
Yeah. Now, I've seen that so many times, even with this show, and I'm dealing with very, you know, I'm dealing with victims of abuse within a very fundamentalist sect of, you know, Christians, and you know, there's some good people that are more conservative, and then there's also some people that are, you know, they lean toward that almost, you know, that very extreme kind of sect. And there's, you know, I see that happen where someone will share about abuse that happened as a child in the church, and, you know, the pastor will say, well, you know, you don't have credibility because now you're sleeping with somebody outside of marriage. And it's like, what does that thing have to do with this very real trauma? And, you know, it's, again, it's those qualifiers you mentioned where we want to make sure that someone's meeting all of our criteria before we'll hear them, before we'll help them, before we'll actually just sit and listen to them. And I think that's really, really unfortunate.
I mean, that hurts my heart even hearing that, that someone would try to disqualify someone's experience. Wow.
Yeah.
And I think that is the thing that does more harm than healing, right?
Yeah.
But yet we will use scripture to justify our mistreatment of neighbor, right?
Yeah. I mean,
it's unfortunate.
I mean, that's been even with myself. I mean, that's one of the questions I get asked all the time is, you know, are you still a Christian? Are you still, you know, or are you this? And you know, I'm pretty vocal in the show that I am, you know, like that's something, you know, that's part of who I am. I'm very open about it, talk about it. You know, but one of the biggest things that has rattled my faith in the last year and a half since starting the show has been the response of pastors and Christians who, you know, it turned a totally deaf ear to, hey, there's this much abuse happening in this church, or there's this, you know, this is being mishandled. The way we deal with, you know, Christian counseling is broken. The way that we try to listen to, you know, rape victims in the church is broken. You know, the way we treat women is broken. And all that they hear is, you're stepping out of line. Are you still one of us? And, you know, my point is always, you know, there's a context in which I'm very happy to talk about my faith, and I openly do generally. But if you're not going to hear, you know, what I'm saying because of, you know, whatever my faith is, you know, if you're going to say, I don't care to hear about, you know, molestation or rape within the church because you're not one of us, that's a big red flag for me, you know. And that's something that, you know, for me, like I've mentioned time and time again, like that's been the biggest, you know, it's been the biggest thing that's done damage to my faith, is seeing Christians and pastors insert those qualifiers before they'll hear about an issue that is a black and white bipartisan, like with your Christian, non-Christian pastor or not, like, let's tackle this, you know, like this is a problem regardless of that. You can ask me about that some other time too, but the issue I'm approaching you with is an issue regardless of who it's coming from, regardless of who's telling you about it. And so it is, it's really tragic. And it's really tragic when I see that happen to victims, you know, when I see that happen to, I've had pastors that have commented and said, you know, she has no credibility because she lives this way now, or, you know, they don't have any credibility because they're not a Christian now, or, you know, all of these different statements that blanket somebody as being unhelpable or untrustworthy or unreachable. you know, it's really tragic to me. And it's one of the reasons that I wanted to have you on is to address that kind of mentality, because I see in your book a lot of the opposite. You know, I see that, you know.
Yeah, I mean, you think about it, man. People who try to belittle or dismiss people based upon their experiences does more to protect the abuser than the abused, which is very harmful and is antithetical to the life and witness of the historical Jesus I follow, right?
Why do you think so many struggle with that? Why do you think so many would rather, there was a pastor just recently was preaching, and he was, obviously you don't know the whole situation, but just broadly, I mean, just to give context, and he was saying, if somebody from outside of our world, outside of the Independent Baptist world, credibly accuses somebody, you know, even if they have a good point about somebody within our movement, I'm biased to believe the person in our movement because he's, you know, he's not one of those crazy people outside. He said, basically, I tend to always lean toward agreeing with the person in our camp. Even if I'm pretty sure they're wrong, I'm going to stand by them. Why do you think we tend to have this kind of tribal, you know, mentality when it comes to who we listen to, who we help? Where do you think that comes from? That us versus them?
I think it comes from, you know, patriarchy, power, dominance. I think it comes from a lot of things, man. And even listening to that as a Black man in America, you know, this religious Christian nationalism that is, you know, largely white, right? That has seeped in racism since the earliest days of the America's colonial settlement. And with this stance, you know, history is even sanitized, right? removing the sins of genocide and slavery and Jim Crow laws and all of the things that has saturated and sustained this very stained society and culture. So like there are times when I'm even called a Marxist or like all of these crazy things because I am both Christian and I am Black, but I was Black before I was Christian, right? Mm. And my Blackness is still, you know, when I walk outside, I still have to think about in the back of my mind, will I be treated, you know, or mishandled inappropriately by people who fear my skin color? They have no idea that I follow Jesus. They have no idea that I leave a nonprofit. They have no idea of all of those things. And just because I'm Christian does not separate me from the mistreatment that I experience in society and culture. And I think it's time for people to really wake up and stop trying to sanitize the stories of those who are Black and brown or who have experienced any type of trauma in this society and culture that has been highly patriarchal and dominated by people who have this affinity and addiction to power, right? Yeah. Jesus himself was killed and executed because he challenged people who withheld power from those who were oppressed. Howard Thurman says in his book, Jesus and the Disinherited, that Jesus was born poor. He was born a minority and under a Roman oppression. And so he understands what it means to have his back against the wall and to be criticized. This same Jesus experienced acute homelessness, sleeping around from place to place, right? While he was, in his earthly ministry. You know, foxes have holes, birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has what? Nowhere to lay his head, right? Mm. And yet on Sunday mornings, we could worship Jesus who experienced homelessness, but as Christians walk past a person on the street who identifies with the person that we call our Savior, right? And I think it's a very dichotomous, and cognitive dissonance that's happening amongst people who are in the Christian faith. And I think it's something that needs to be addressed. That just because you want to stand up for those who have been oppressed doesn't make you any less Christian. You're just identifying with the person and work of Jesus. That just because you want to challenge people who withhold power from those who are oppressed with the truth doesn't mean that you're less Christian. And just because you want to side with those who have been abused and victimized and experienced trauma doesn't make you a less Christian than those who tend to be more relating their faith to, like, you know, what some sect or community is doing, right? And I think we need to push back against some of those narratives, because in many ways, sometimes it can become very legalistic and people are you know, behaving more out of what a community does versus really modeling what Jesus would do in the scriptures.
And I don't want to add too much more to that because I feel like you said it kind of perfectly, but I know in your book, you gave an example and kind of drew a parallel between how Paul spoke to believers and kind of drew it to Martin Luther King Jr. Speaking about humanity as a world house. And I think that kind of is a perfect stepping stone from where you were just talking. Can you talk a little bit about that example, maybe for somebody that's never heard it, kind of break down what that looks like and how that changes how you see the world around you?
Yeah, I mean, Martin King, in his 1967 Christmas sermon, he goes into this long exposition of how we can't even wake up in the morning without having a global experience. He starts to say, where did you get your coffee from? Where were the clothes that you have on your back? Where were they made? You know, where did you get your decor from? He starts talking about our brothers and sisters from all around the world, right? And he uses world house in this very powerful language to suggest that the world is our address, right? He's trying to communicate to us that we're all interconnected. And I think people who operate and function from a very separatist mindset tries to disconnect themselves with their brothers and sisters or their neighbors around them, right? Oftentimes use this phraseology as, you know, borrowing King's statement and sentiment of a world house, because, you know, when we think about it, what I do for you, brother, I'm also doing for myself.
We are made to live together because of the interrelated structure of reality. And did you ever stop to think that you can't leave for your job in the morning without being dependent on most of the world? You get up in the morning and go to the bathroom and reach over for a sponge, and that's handed to you by a Pacific Islander. You reach for a bar of soap, and that's given to you at the hands of a Frenchman. And then you go in the kitchen to drink your coffee for the morning, and that's poured in your cup by a South American. Or maybe you want tea, that's poured in your cup by a Chinese. Or maybe you are desirous of having cocoa for breakfast, and that's poured in your cup by a West African. And then you reach over for your toast, and that's given to you at the hands of an English-speaking farmer, not to mention the baker. And before you finish eating breakfast in the morning, you are dependent on more than half of the world. This is the way our universe is structured. It is its interrelated quality. We aren't going to have peace on earth until we recognize this basic fact of the interrelated structure of all reality.
I remember interviewing one of my mentors for a film that we recorded.
He talked about how he went from, you know, living in the suburbs to moving into an impoverished community to start an organization 40 years ago. Obviously, he's a person who had a tremendous amount of excess and wealth to be able to make this happen. Yeah. And so he did it. And he says, you know, when I was at a distance, it was kind of hard to understand the plights and the problems of my brothers and sisters. But he says, when I moved in the community and I started to attend church with my neighbors and be more proximate and hold conversations, their struggles became my struggles. It was no longer a them versus me mentality. It was an only us mentality. And I think that is the type of, you know, heart's posture that we should take when we look at victims of abuse, when we look at our homeless populations, when we look at people who have been marginalized and displaced and excluded. You know, I mean, think about it, man. When I look back in history and I look at redlining and what that did for the Black community and not giving equal access to just housing, and, you know, mirroring that with how persons of color make up, you know, a large percentile of people experiencing homelessness. You know, could that be a direct correlation from not having access to adequate housing? Yes, you know. But it was these laws that discriminated against persons of color or Black people were set up by those who saw themselves as being separate.
Right.
And what I'm saying is, when you see yourself as being separate, you set yourself up in a place to do damage to those that you think you're separate from.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I definitely could talk about this all day. I'm curious. I wanted to leave with some practical advice for people who are sitting here. Because like I said, there's a lot of people who are hearing these things, you know. I think specifically people listening to my show are seeing they're going, there's this problem of, you know, sexual abuse. There's this problem of, you know, this, but there might be people listening who also strongly resonate. I know I have a lot of people that, you know, over the past year or over the past couple years, you know, seeing the racial divide are wanting to become better advocates in that area. People who are seeing homelessness are wanting to become better advocates in this area. So this can really be applicable to anybody who has a cause that they're passionate about. But could you give maybe two to three action steps for somebody who's listening right now and they're saying, I want to be a better advocate. I want to adjust my life in a way where I can better serve people, where it's not just a Instagram post, where it's not just, you know, me being scattered across four or five different ministries at my church. I want to get really focused, really start making a big difference. What steps would you recommend they take after listening to this episode and start moving in that direction?
Yeah, it's a great question. One, I think people need to be realistic about what's on their plate, which is very untraditional, because I would like to suggest things, but I don't want to suggest things to people who are willing, but they're not available. Right. Yeah. And I think this availability issue is directly connected to the issue of margin. What do you need to let go of? What do you need to remove off of your plate so you can free up the type of margin in your life where you can give yourself to something in a more consistent way? Because I tell you, if you have a cause and if you're only given just a small amount, you know, even though that small amount is important, you know, more than likely it's not going to become something that is rhythmic to your life. It's not going to become the hum that you were talking about, where you're not just like giving everything, but it never leaves you and you never have to set an alarm clock and remind yourself about the things that you're passionate about. So the first thing I would say is I would challenge people to let go of a few things, to ask yourself, you know, is this that I'm holding on to really having an eternal impact, or does it add the type of value that I would really want added to my life in a meaningful way if I freed myself up to get involved in something that is related to my heart's passion? The second thing is change your routine. I was given a talk on another podcast or somewhere, and a person asked me a similar question. And I was like, bro, like, where do you get your coffee from? And he, you know, named the place. And I was like, you're talking about you want to be an advocate for Black and brown people, but you don't even shop or get coffee from a coffee shop that's owned by a Black and brown person. Like, change your routine, get out of the comfort zone of your own community. And even if it's once a week, go into areas where you can make yourself available to build some of those types of relationships. Because it's one thing to be a spokesperson on behalf of someone, but it's another thing to be proximate enough to learn the stories of individuals that you want to pass the microphone to.
Yeah,
we don't need any more people being a voice for the voiceless. We have voices already. Some people's voices are heard while others are silenced. We need advocates that are daring and bold enough to use their privilege to pass the microphone, right? But you can't pass a microphone to a person that you've never been proximate to. And then the last thing is, I would say, man, you know, just start. You know, find the place, find the organization, do the research, show up. I don't even care if it's for 15 to 30 minutes. Show up. Stop putting it off. Create the margin. You know, start another routine, and show up. And then, you know, journal about it. Create community around it. Talk about it. Process it. Notice how it's changing you. Because sometimes we want to just bring change to communities without realizing that those communities already have a lot of treasure. They can change you.
Yeah.
You can become your best version of who you are as you show up and walk with people and stand in solidarity in the struggle. And that's what I have, man.
Yeah. I can't tell you how much it means to me to pass the microphone, because that's been something I've been trying to say from day one. Is, you know, a lot of people have talked about, oh, you know, again, even pastors, you know, use your platform for this, or why are you present? And I said, it's not really my platform. Like, for every episode, it's somebody else's platform. Like, I have episodes where it is just me, you know, and, you know, of course, yes. Do I have a platform? Yes. Do I get to share, you know, my opinion on a show that, you know, thankfully some people listen to? That's great. But every episode where I'm sitting down with a survivor, or every episode I'm sitting down with an expert, like, I'm passing the microphone to somebody. And, you know, sometimes those people are, you know, stooping down to be willing to share a stage and be willing to grab a microphone and raise awareness about this, you know. But there's, you know, there's people who, like you said, they already have a voice. They're just being silenced. You know, these women that were abused in the church have had a voice, but they've been silenced being in the pew for years and years and years, while many times the abuser has a microphone in his hand every Sunday and is preaching at the pulpit. And so being able to pass that microphone is everything. I mean, that sums up so much of what I feel about this show. And what I wish I would see more pastors and more Christians do is be willing to lean in, hand the microphone to somebody who hasn't had a voice, and just listen to them. They may say some things you disagree with. They may be doing some things you disagree with. Whatever. You're probably doing things that they disagree with. Like, sit in and listen to the things that are objectively bad and wrong that happened to them, and offer support. You know, like, offer. And sometimes support is just that. It's just listening and letting someone share their story and feel that weight come off of, I got to say what happened. And that's really powerful. I really do appreciate you saying that, because I think that's one of the biggest takeaways I hope people take away from this show, is just as a whole, is let people share their stories, pass that microphone, and let them say it in their voice, not the sanitized version that you want them to share, like the actual story that they want to share. That's awesome. I know we're getting near the end of our time, so I do want to encourage people, if you haven't picked up a copy, When We Stand, be sure to grab that. There's a link in the show notes. You can check it out. You can, if you Google it, it'll pop up. But for you, Terrence, if people want to connect with you, what's the best ways to do that? Obviously, there's some people that may want to know about your nonprofit, but also give them a chance to connect with you personally. If you have a social media platform, that would be best.
Yeah, for sure. You know, you summarize our conversation so perfectly, and you know, it's been a privilege of being on the show and the podcast with you. Love the work that you're doing. So if you want to look us up, you can, you know, look us up at lovebeyondwalls.org. Love Beyond Walls is Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And if you want to follow me on any of my social media platforms, that's I'm Terrence Lester. I'm Terrence Lester.
Perfect. Perfect. Yeah, definitely. Like I said, go check that out, guys. Go connect with Terrence. Let him know you appreciate him on the show. Be sure to grab a copy of When We Stand. Just buy it right now, because you'll forget. Whenever you hear a recommendation on a podcast, always just grab the book right then and there. It's well worth your time. And if you appreciate anything in the conversation, you're going to get that tenfold in the book. But thank you so much, Terrence, for joining me on the show. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the Preacher Boys podcast. If you appreciated the content on the show, please leave a review on iTunes, and don't forget to connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter with the handle at Preacher Boys Doc. Additional information can always be found on PreacherBoysDoc.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.